It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's How to Party with Oscar. So what would one eat while watching Seabiscuit, Lord of the Rings, or Master and Commander? Movie buff and food historian Francine Segan has it all. She's author of Movie Menus. Well, the Sterns have found a safe haven in San Diego for an endangered species, the glorious chicken croquette. Wine maverick Josh Wesson does stick to your ribs reds on the cheap. Then it's raw horse liver, karaoke, and one of America's great French chefs, Danielle Ballou, goes to Tokyo. And we have stories of the men behind the booze from Playboy magazine's A.J. Bame. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Red ripe tomatoes, I'm never satisfied. I want the frim-fram sauce with the aus and fade, with shafafa on the side. I don't want pork chops and bacon that won't awaken my appetite inside. I want the frim-fram sauce with the aus and fade, with shafafa on the side. Well, you know a girl, she really got to eat, and a girl, she should eat right. Five will get you ten. I'm gonna feed myself right tonight. I don't want fish cakes and rye bread. You heard what I said, waiter, please. I want my fried, I want the frim-fram sauce with the awesome fay, with shafafa all on the side. Shoo-doo-dee-doo-ya-doo-doo. Shoo-ba-doo-ya-doo-shee-ya-din-doo. My appetite inside. I want the frim-fram with the Alls and Faye, with Shafafa on the side. Now you know, girls, we really got to eat, and you know we should eat right. Fire will get you ten. I'm gonna feed myself right tonight. I don't want fish cakes and rye bread. You heard what I said. Waiter, please, I want my mind fried. I want the frim fram sauce with the Alls and Faye, with Shafafa on the side.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's time to upgrade your TV tray. We are partying with Oscar. Movie buff and food historian Francine Segan matches menus to the Best Picture nominees. Wine maverick Josh Wesson talks comfort wines like A Van from La Mancha with aromas of cherry pie and wood smoke. Who can resist that? Then one of America's great French chefs, Danielle Blou, takes on Tokyo. Crime and Nourishment reports on new research in a British prison. And as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. So, Jane, Michael, where have you been wandering?
We have been wandering around San Diego, California, and we have been to one of our favorite places there. It's the last of a special breed of restaurant that used to thrive throughout Southern California, a deluxe urban coffee shop. It's called Hobnob Hill. It's been there since 1944, and we love it three meals a day.
Is this the kind of place that Mildred Pierce, that old 40s movie with Joan Crawford, you know, it was sort of a place where you get fried chicken, but it was formica tables and that kind of thing?
Oh, Lynn, you're a genius. That's exactly what it's like. That's that, except for the fact that Joan Crawford in her scary incarnation is not hovering over you. What's wonderful about Hobnob Hill, beside from the fact that they make everything from scratch and they have the greatest layer cakes and coffee cakes and pancakes, the waitresses have just charmed our pants off. They are old-style 1940s waitresses wearing uniforms, crisp white aprons like waitresses at Schraft's used to wear, big orthopedic shoes that they sort of scrunch around, and it sounds like they have erasers, you know, taped to their feet. And they talk in this kind of highway patrol code. They order a 101 on 20, which means table 20 needs service. A 50 on 10 summons a busboy to table 10 immediately. 104 to the counter alerts the staff that someone at the short order counter needs a check. I mean, it's just a delightful slice of the past.
But let me say that lest you think this place is at all gruff based on what Jane said, this is in some ways one of the most civilized restaurants at any price I've been to. I mean, I don't think you can spend more than $10 for dinner there. And yet, when you get your salad course before, let's say, the meatloaf or the fried chicken, the salad is put down on the table, the waitress walks away and then returns with a plate on which is a napkin, and on that napkin is a chilled fork that you pick up to eat your salad with.
How lovely!
It's very Emily Post. That you love. They also serve chicken croquettes, which, as I'm sure you know, Lynn, is one of the endangered foodstuffs. I mean, who makes chicken croquettes anymore?
I have petitioned the Smithsonian about saving the chicken croquette because you never see them. I gather they're good chicken croquettes, right?
Oh, they're wonderful with homemade gravy. And you know, of course, meals are accompanied by warm from the oven dinner rolls. Good. Even the butter is good. Everything about this place is just a cut above. Nothing is ordinary or mundane? I mean, from the breakfast Jane was mentioning, I mean, many people in San Diego think of Hobnob Hill as a breakfast place simply because the pastries are so good, the waffles, the pancakes. I don't think they get anything ready-made.
Is it a big place?
Pretty big, yeah. It's a couple or three dining rooms. There's a short counter where you can sit if you're a single diner. Big as it is, however, if you go there on a weekend morning, you will wait outside in line. It's very popular, especially among the locals. It's curiously enough, it's not in any tourist guides except the ones that Jane and I write, because it's so, you know, it's not California cuisine, except in that old-fashioned sense that it's California coffee shop cuisine. And there's nothing spectacular about it except for the whole package, which is in fact spectacular.
My favorite thing there at the end of the meal is an individual bundt cake with chocolate frosting.
An individual one?
Yes.
It's just so
lovely.
Precious.
Just lovely.
Oh, I wish there were one in my neighborhood.
Oh, I know. And that's the great thing about Hobnob Hill. It's really a singular restaurant. It is not anything that could ever be franchised.
Oh, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, wander to the world with me, and any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
The Stearns are the authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, every week you hear them here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're roaming the site, don't miss signing up for our weekly newsletter. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every single week, we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique tips, and shopping tips. And best of all, it's free. So sign up on the website, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert who took a different turn in life. Now, a lot of successful sommeliers like Josh dream of having their own wine shops, but no one has done what Josh did. Since he believes good wine can be had for modest money, he put together Bestsellers Wine Shops, where nothing costs more than $15 a bottle, which is why I am always curious to find out what his latest find is. Josh, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, Josh, what have you got for me in red wines? Because we're doing a lot of heavy, big, you know, comfort food kind of stuff at this time of year.
Yeah, you know, I mean, rib tickling reds are some of my favorite wines in the world. And often I think of the Rhone or a big Australian Shiraz. But when I went out and shopped for this segment, I found a couple of wines from places that I don't drink all that much wine from, and I was astounded by how good they were, how satisfying they were, in that umami factor, that thing that makes you flap your lips and smack them up and down and go, and then grab the bottle. You know, you don't even have to bother with a glass with these. You just sort of, you know, lick it like an orange knee-high.
A straw will do. Okay.
A bendy straw. It aerates the wine.
All right. So which is number one?
Well, Spain is a hot zone for rib, sticky, heartwarming wines, and I found a wine from the central part of Spain, very near Madrid, in a region next to La Mancha, called Bodegas. This is a mouthful, just like the wine. Casa de la Ermita, and it comes from a place called Jumilla. It's you could call this a van from La Mancha, but it's a blend of Monastrell, Tempranillo, and good old Cabernet, and they put it in a vat and mix it all together, and out comes this remarkably rich, silky, jam-packed, plummy red that smells like a cross between cherry pie and campfire smoke.
Ooh,
and just. You can't help but get excited by a wine that smells that way, and it tastes every bit as good. And here's the best part: it's only $12.
Oh boy!
So, you know, throw that in the back of your closet and pull it out when the temperature drops, and I think you'd be very, very happy.
So okay, we were in Spain. Now, where else are you going to take us?
I'm going to take you a little bit farther south. My new favorite red grape for winter is Malbec, And I'm sure that you've heard of Malbec. It's a mixing grape, a blending grape in Bordeaux. But when they take it down to Argentina in the Mendoza, where this next wine that I'm going to talk about comes from, they make it in a really rich, full-bodied, strapping style. And I'm enamored of wines like this when the temperature drops, because they bring you right back up to 98.6 with two sips.
So what's the name of it?
Ben Marco is the producer, and the wine is called Dominio del Plata, and it's a Malbec that has a little bit of Bonarda in it. And Bonarda is a very popular grape in Argentina. It's a red grape. Don't see it grown in very many other places. And it adds a kind of a ping of red cherry acidity to this otherwise very rich, full-bodied, almost chewy wine.
Mm-hmm.
And it balances the wine in ways that straight Malbec sometimes don't achieve. And I was so taken with this, I actually bought a case and brought it up to a friend's ski house, and it was the hit. There were many more expensive wines on the table when we were having our dinners over the weekend, and this was the wine of the weekend. It's a little bit more than $15, but not much more. It's around $19-$20, but worth every peso, every penny.
So this sounds like serious drinking for people who are really into wine.
Yeah, it is serious drinking. You know, some Malbecs are so big you can just cut them. They don't even come in a bottle. And you sort of dish them out.
by the pound.
Right, exactly. But this one has that extra kiss of mouthwatering sweetness from the Bonarda, and it's a real winner.
Okay, we've been to Spain, we've been to Argentina. What's the next stop?
Now, I would be remiss in my duties as a former sommelier if I didn't bring up a rib-sticking rich red from France. But this one that I'm about to talk about doesn't come from the Rhone. It comes from an area just south of the Rhone, heading down towards the Spanish border. It's in the Languedoc, which is a great place to look for rich reds, spicy reds, especially if you don't want to pay a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is Chateau Combelle, C-O-M-B-E-L-L-E, pretty to pronounce, from Saint-Chinian. It's a beautiful little area, subdivision of the Languedoc. And it's a blend of Syrah and Grenache, and it's spicy, and it's sweet, and it's big, and it's rich, but it's not mouth-furring. It doesn't have a lot of tannin the way some other red wines that you drink in the wintertime have. And because of that, it can go with an incredibly wide range of winter foods. It's very friendly at the table, very flexible. And spicy and just fun to drink. It makes you smile.
This is great. Okay. Hey, Josh, thank you.
Thank you.
Wine expert Joshua Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, you can get Josh's red wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Talking wine for comfort food this week had me scanning my shelves for my favorite cookbooks for comfort food. You know, I define that as recipes that you know will work and that tastes great. Well, I realize that there are some key names to look for. Anything with Marion Burrow's name on it has got to be a winner. Her latest is Cooking for Comfort. Now, the same is true about Cheryl Julian and Julie Riven. Like Marion, their stuff is really tested to work. Try out their book, The Way We Cook. It's simple and the food is really good. Three chefs get awards from me for thinking like home cooks. Now, one is Tom Douglas. Anything the Seattle chef does is aces. His Tom's Big Dinner delivers entire menus. Two New York chefs have the same touch. David Waltuck's Staff Meals keeps making us so happy. And Tom Valenti's Soup Stews and One Pot Meals, it's a pure joy. So check out your library and then head for the wine shop. Coming up, party food for Oscar night and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Well, in honor of the Academy Awards, we have some culinary drama for you. This story asks the question, what does a New York City psychologist do for a second career? Well, if she's Francine Segan, she becomes a food historian, a lecturer, and ends up writing a book about dining with movies called Movie Menus, Recipes for Perfect Meals with Your Favorite Films. Francine, welcome.
Oh, hi, Lynn.
Okay, Francine, your time has come. Now, I want you to help us get ready for Oscar night. I have got three of the movies nominated for Best Picture in mind, and I'd like you to come up with a menu. So let's start with Seabiscuit.
Well, Seabiscuit was set back in America's Depression years, and that was a very interesting time period. Coming right with Prohibition, where people weren't allowed to drink, we can start our meal with a little cocktail of Prohibition Punch, which was a bunch of fruit juices. And the intention was that you could then put in a little of your bootleg whiskey, and the punch would be so great that you wouldn't mind the harsh taste of the whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can move on to a very popular 20s and 30s dish called Three Peas Salad. If you can believe it, Lynn, they mixed pickles, peanuts, and peas in a salad.
Pickles, peanuts, and peas?
I know. It's very hard to believe. I thought it was going to be awful, so I made it thinking that it would be a funny side story of how terrible it was, and I was shocked. The sweet pickles, the nice, wonderful peas, the peanuts for the crunch, tossed in a great mayonnaise vinaigrette and then served in an iceberg lettuce leaf. It is, brings you back to the past, and it is worth rediscovering.
Okay. I'm going to take your word for this one. What's the main dish for the Depression?
I associate the Depression so much with the Italian immigrants coming in. I would make a wonderful spaghetti and meatballs with eggplant as my main course.
Okay, and that would be pretty cheap to pull off even then.
Absolutely. A favorite with the gangsters that were popular during the Prohibition.
Okay, let's go back in time. How about Master and Commander?
Oh, I loved that movie. Russell Crowe is great. It's set in 1805, so it's perfect for a high seas, high tea. We can serve things like English scones with preserves, a Sally Lunn cake, which was a great no-knead bread, and lemon cake. Keep them from getting some scurvy.
That's right, because the sailors needed vitamin C.
And I love the lemon cake recipe that I have in Movie Menus because it was from a very famous cookbook written in the early 1800s by the sister of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. Well, her sister Catherine did a cookbook that became a huge bestseller in the 1800s.
Huh. All right, further back in time, and this is one of the big contenders, Lord of the Rings.
Well, Lord of the Rings reminds me of the Middle Ages. So let's set it in the Middle Ages and eat the way they might have in the Middle Ages. So how about 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie? They really did serve that to entertain the guests. They'd cut into the pie and the birds would fly through the room. So for us, for our Oscar night party, we could make maybe little individual meat pies. And we can serve another dish that was very popular during the Middle Ages, a Neapolitan eggplant from a Neapolitan cookbook that gave us the instructions for how long to cook the eggplant, to cook it for about as long as it takes to say to our fathers, which I thought was just very funny. You know, they didn't have clocks in kitchens back then.
And we don't have to put live birds in the meat pie, right?
Unless you really want to go over the top.
Okay. What else on this menu?
We could make a penne with saffron cream sauce. It's a recipe that I found for one of the first for ravioli. But I deconstructed it because it was just takes too long and I have to get to my movie watching. So the filling becomes a little meatball and then the sauce is just tossed with store-bought pasta. Mm-hmm. It's still a great flavor combination.
And saffron was really big back then.
Oh, they loved gold. They actually cooked with gold because they thought it was restorative and would make you have your youth and vigor back. And so anything that colored the food gold was a favorite.
So how would you end that meal?
Oh, with one of my favorite desserts for any time period. It's a sweet cheese. It's just a mixture in the blender of ricotta and some fruit liqueur and frozen cherries whipped up and put in the fridge just before serving. It is like the creamiest, best ice cream, just not quite as cold.
That sounds great. Okay, big question. What's your pick for best film?
Lord of the Rings. I think that they will make Oscar history as being the only fantasy film to win Best Picture.
Well, okay, Francine, your pick has been documented. It's going to be Lord of the Rings. And thanks.
No, oh, thank you, and happy watching.
Lay down your sweet and weary head. Night is falling. You've come to Jenny's end.
That's Annie Lennox with the Oscar-nominated song Into the West from Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. Well, food historian Francine Segan is author of Movie Menus, recipes for perfect meals with your favorite films. Now, you can find those menus and some suggestions for other nominees as well on the website, splendidtable.org. When the name Danielle Belleau is uttered in star chef circles, a hush falls, heads bow. This Frenchman, who has built a restaurant empire in New York, is considered the master's master. A couple of months ago, he was invited to do an event at the very same hotel where Lost in Translation takes place, the Park Hyatt in Tokyo. Reporter Scott Haas traveled with Danielle on this, his first trip to Japan. Now, we join them at what would be the end of the evening, at least for most people.
We're in downtown Tokyo. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning. We're at a sake restaurant called Toritake. We've had some chicken livers. We're going to have some raw chicken soon. In front of me is a quivering, beautiful, fat-laden piece of pork, and Danielle Belleau is about to slice it.
Ooh, it looked very tender.
It does look very tender. So this is your first time in Tokyo, right?
Yes.
Tell me about the event tonight.
The chicken is not totally cooked yet.
No, it's sashimi.
Oh my God!
It's raw chicken.
Yeah. In New York, we worry about salmonella.
Right.
Here, they don't even know what salmonella means.
No.
So that's definitely
that's
a
serious,
good thing.
That's very serious business. Raw chicken.
Can I give you a skewer here too?
I'd be thrilled. What was the purpose of the event tonight?
The purpose?
Yeah.
Oh, it was mostly that I wanted to come to Japan. I mean, I've been working with Japanese chef for the past 30 years, I would say, as a young chef in Lyon. And so I feel always so connected with them, and yet I never had been to their country. So
one of the dishes you're known for is the tuna dish.
Mm.
What is the name of that? How would you describe that?
It's a tuna tartare with wasabi. Lemon zest, grated lemon zest, seasoned with wasabi, a little bit of chive, and it's molded into a ring and covered with caviar. And I serve a sweet lemon sauce, which is Moroccan-style cured lemon mixed with lemon juice and olive oil. And I have a little cucumber, crisp cucumber with it. So it's a very clean, simple dish.
When I spoke to two or three Japanese people today about that dish, they told me that they looked at it very incredulously, and they said they thought it was a Japanese dish.
Yep.
by the colors, by the presentation,
totally.
By the taste.
But when I created that dish, I had in mind that this was as clean and certainly pure as Japanese dish.
Uh-huh. You were at the famous Tsukiji. You were at the famous Tsukiji fish market this week. What was that like?
It was a thrilling experience.
It's huge.
It was very early in the morning, bustling like I've never seen. You see this market, and you say, where is all this fish going?
Yeah.
Millions of tons of, I mean, thousands of tons of fish going out of this market. One of the fish was about 450 pounds, and I think it went for something like $8,000 or something.
Who is eating these fish for $8,000?
I mean, well,
are they paying that here?
They're paying the price here.
Wow.
Oh, sake. Kanpai.
That's a very large glass of sake.
Ooh, that's a lot serving. So in New York, we have to keep our fish always very cold in order to keep it fresh. But here they buy it so fresh that they're going to serve it that day, and they let it temper it a little bit. So the it's like a great wine. You don't want it to chill.
Right. What do you think we can learn from the Japanese about gastronomy and about cooking?
Well, I think we can learn all we want. We're not going to beat them.
Beat them on freshness, you mean? And
yeah. I wish, but it would never happen, but I wish in my career then I will buy a beautiful piece of fish, slice it up, and give it to you on the plate with a little bit of wasabi, and you enjoy it.
So why won't that happen?
Because I'm expected to cook beyond just the sliced fish.
Right. All right, so they're putting this in front of you. That is unclear.
Oh, man, this is raw liver here.
Oh, it's raw? This is the raw horse meat?
No way. Are we going to cook it on something?
No. Sashimi.
This is raw horse meat.
I am vegetarian.
I was going to say. Yeah, this is pretty strong stuff.
No way I'm going to eat that either.
It's marbled, very heavily marbled. It was a
this
fat horse.
This is freaky. Next time you come to Danielle, I'll give you a nice plate of raw liver.
Perfect.
Raw heart.
Perfect.
Maybe I'll make a raw blood sauce for
Fantastic. I was going to ask you, what do you think you're going to take back to New York with you in terms of what you...
I'm not going to take that dish in front of me. That's for sure.
No raw horse meat next week at Danielle. You are eating the raw horse meat.
Yeah, I'm going to have a bite. Mm. I think the wasabi helped going down.
Yeah, that's kind of rough looking. I admire you for eating it, though.
Next! I think you have to be a real carnivore here.
I think so.
I didn't know they were so carnivore here.
They eat everything. So later tonight you're going to be doing the karaoke, I understand?
Oh, are we? Yeah.
Is that what I hear? I don't know. That's...
Yeah, no, it's going to be fun. I mean, a good old-fashioned French song.
That'd be nice, a little bit of Edith Piaf, you know.
Why not? Yeah.
Reporter Scott Haas is the author of Are We There Yet? Perfect Family Vacations and Other Fantasies. Chef Danielle Ballou has Restaurant Danielle and several others in New York City.
Come on, baby, light my fire. No, that's too lousy. Come on, baby, light my fire. Yeah. Set the night on fire.
Yeah. Yes. That was Danielle Ballou, and I am so glad that he's picked the career that he has. You know that old saw about everything has a story behind it? Well, the booze in your liquor store is no exception. In fact, drinks often have great tales to tell. A.J. Bame, whose day job is articles editor for Playboy magazine, has researched a couple of stories in his book, Big Shots, The Men Behind the Booze. A.J., welcome.
Thanks so much, Lynn. Great to be here.
So, AJ, why alcohol?
why not alcohol? There's a story in every glass. One of the things I'd always been curious about are who these people are, like Jack Daniel, who he really was, Jose Cuervo. And, you know, I remember reading when I was young some stories about who the real Captain Morgan was. And I just found that, you know, through all these stories, you could really tell the whole story of the history of alcohol through these wonderful profiles, which are full of intrigue and sex and war, and you name it.
You know, one of the stories I'd love for you to tell is about Smirnoff vodka. I mean, it's certainly the vodka I most identify with Russia.
Well, vodka had been around in Russia, Eastern Europe, for a couple centuries. The Smirnoffs were really the first, to my knowledge, family that created a brand of vodka that was very popular and made them a lot of money. They made the vodka for the Russian court. And in 1917, when the Bolsheviks installed Lenin in power, mm-hmm. the Smirnoffs, Vladimir and Nikolai, the two heirs of the company, were found guilty of being, quote, enemies of the people. Their distillery was turned into a parking garage, and one of them was executed, and the other escaped to France and lived a while longer, died poor and unknown, and the vodka brand Smirnoff, as we know it, was gone, seemingly forever, one would think.
But then what happened?
There was a guy named John G. Martin, who decided he wanted to start a vodka company, America, which was really asinine by any standard of business. But anyway, this guy ran a company called Hublin, which some listeners might know, had launched a steak sauce called A1.
Uh-huh.
Using profits from A1 and some other Hublin products, he started a vodka distillery, purchased the name Smirnoff for $14,000, and began pumping out something he called Smirnoff white whiskey. No smell, no taste. The vodka was not selling, so they needed a gimmick, and he found that they were selling the vodka in whiskey bottles. They noticed that the top of the bottle said whiskey, and it began to sell because people thought it was this strange kind of new whiskey, so they rolled with it.
When was this?
This was in 1939. He purchased the distillery. It wasn't really until the 50s or the late 40s that things began to take off. Most people don't know that vodka in America, which is now the most popular spirit category, vodka didn't really exist here. It was very hard to find. People had never even heard of it before World War II.
So going from vodka, let's talk about rum, because you have a story about Cuba. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Bacardi, the fantastic story of Bacardi, started in 1862. Don Facundo Bacardi Masso spent 3,500 pesos, but nothing basically, to begin making very fine rum. At the time, rum was a base drink. It was very crude and not well-liked. And Bacardi was the first guy to launch this company that eventually exploded as a global phenomenon, spread all over the world. By the time Castro took power in Cuba, this company was the largest liquor company in the world. And Castro tried to usurp the company. It was a communist regime. He wanted to, you know, nationalize the assets.
Uh-huh.
So the whole Bacardi clan escaped Cuba, and they actually ran their company from a boat off Miami before settling in the Bahamas. It's a fascinating story.
So now, I understand that there was something about an assassination attempt in the book?
The Bacardis, they had such a tremendous amount of money and so much, you know, vitriol was boiling over regarding what had happened in Cuba, and they were really attached to their homeland. So basically, 30 years afterward, CIA documents came out pointing to the fact that the Bacardis, the clan, or actually at least the individual who was their CEO, was helping to fund CIA assassination attempts in Cuba to try to rid the nation of Castro so that they could move back home.
I'm going to remember this the next time I have a mojito. Hey, thanks a lot, AJ.
Thank you so much.
AJ Baim is author of Big Shots, The Men Behind the Booze. AJ is articles editor for Playboy magazine. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, we're going to go right to those phones. We've got Amy on the line. So, Amy, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about Dutch ovens.
Oh, okay.
I recently bought a wonderful casserole book, but every other recipe calls for a Dutch oven, and I really don't know what it is,
yeah,
how to use it, do I really need it, and was hoping you could help me.
Well, what a Dutch oven is essentially is, it's an interesting piece of equipment. It's just a heavy casserole with a lid.
Okay.
But in the days when people used to cook, you know, with the at a fireplace, they would cook with the hot coals, and they would put a pot on the coals or on a little stand so that you just shovel the coals underneath the stand. So that would be like the burner on your stovetop, right? Mm-hmm. And they would have a lid on it that was dished out so that they could put more hot coals on top of it. And it would actually heat from the top and the bottom, and you would do stews, but you might even do things like a pot roast in it or that kind of thing. And that's sort of the origin of the Dutch oven. But today, all it means is a heavy casserole with a lid. So if you've got a heavy casserole that can go on the stovetop and go in the oven, and it has a lid on it, you have a Dutch oven.
Oh, so if I don't, can I just cook the ingredients on the stove and then transport them and put them in another dish?
Sure you can. But you can improvise a cover. I've used cake pans. You know, I've used lids from other pots. So really, you can improvise. As long as it conducts heat really nicely, you're home free.
Oh, great. Well, I'm going to go back and make some food then.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. Now, this comes out of talking about the stories behind the booze. Why would any distiller try to sell his rum by calling it the rum of the bat? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking more of your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. Music. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, here's the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question comes from A.J. Baim's book on the stories behind popular liquors. So here's the question. Why would any distiller try to sell his rum by calling it the rum of the bat? Well, because in Cuba, the bat was considered good luck. It was thought to bring families good health, and there was logic behind this. I mean, since the bat in question was the fruit bat, and it ate mosquitoes, which often carry diseases. Now, in the 1860s, when Don Facundo Bacardi was starting his Bacardi rum business in Cuba, he wanted to distinguish Bacardi rum from the competition. So he put a fruit bat on the label, and today it's still the Bacardi trademark. Now, you know, it's really not that odd. Just think of what Walt Disney did with a mouse. Okay, we're going to get back to those phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see now, who's been waiting? We have got Beth on the line. So, Beth, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, I wanted to know about converted rice. I've seen it in some recipes, and I've never heard of it before.
Ah, well, right now, I mean, in our markets and for years, converted rice has always been connected with one brand. It's called Uncle Ben's, and you've probably seen that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you asked this question. No, the reason why is a while ago, I was at a historic food conference in Charleston, South Carolina. And Charleston and much of South Carolina was, for the longest time, the center for rice growing in the United States. I'm going back to the 18th and 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, there was a rice grown there, and converting was used, which I'll explain to you in a minute. That rice was called Carolina Gold. And do you know it was one of the most prized rices in the entire world?
Wow.
Yeah. And now, this is the deal. Evidently, and at this conference, they talked about converting.
Okay.
This has been going on for thousands of years in India and in Africa. The big trick with rice is that it comes with a very tight, hard-to-remove hull. So what people always had to figure out was how to get that hull off, because the hull was inedible. You know, you wouldn't be able to digest it. And what they figured out was that if they put the rice in a pot and parboiled it and lightly steamed it, it was much easier to then remove the hull. But something else happened at the same time, which they were not aware of until relatively recently. That steaming process actually pushes the nutrients into the center of the grain. So converted rice is more nutritious generally than regular rice. And one of the reasons why you see on the box of Uncle Ben's, Uncle Ben is a black man. And the idea was that originally although it comes out of originally Louisiana, it was this idea that all of the rice growing culture and the technology was brought by African Americans as slaves. The white planters didn't really have a clue. It was those slaves that were brought to raise the rice that knew the technology that was needed to raise rice. So, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to take you down this path. You had a simple question.
Oh, no, this is very interesting.
But it has a great story behind it. It's part of our history and it's part of the world's history. And converted rice, you're pretty safe by Uncle Ben's. Now, most of the time when you see converted rice in a recipe, you can use any long grain rice and you're not going to have a problem. But converted rice, it cooks just the way regular rice does. But the interesting thing about it is that it's probably a bit more nutritious.
Okay, so it's easy to substitute.
Easy to substitute. Any long grain rice would work. You know, long grain white rice would work in place of the converted rice. But if you run across that brand or any other rice that says converted on it, give it a shot.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for a great
Wonderful.
Question.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. I love being able to use stuff I pick up here and there.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You're welcome. You take care, Beth.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can call us at 800-537-5252. We are here. We are available. We've got Jim calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Jim, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn, how are you today?
I am good. What's on your mind?
Well, this is a little different question that you usually get, but we're building a house, brand new house.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And listening to your program every week, I get excited about cooking, and I'm just thinking, what are some of the things that we could think about as we go into build our kitchen, and the things that we can include? So when we get some of your wonderful recipes on your radio show, we could cook them.
Does your family like to cook?
Oh, we love to cook, and my wife loves to bake.
Oh, okay. Oh, boy. Oh, you've hit a nerve. Because, you see, whenever anybody who works in the food business is asked a question like this, of course, what you want to tell people is everything you want for your kitchen that often you don't have.
Of course. It always goes that way.
But, you know, really, there are some basics. I don't think you ever have enough clear counter space, clear, unbroken counter space. And for me personally, I tend to be tall. I only tend to be tall. I'm not actually tall. But at any rate, I find an overhead cabinet over a counter space makes me feel very claustrophobic. Mm-hmm. And I end up doing almost all of my work either on a center island where I feel, you know, very open and free, or in the space in the kitchen where I have a countertop with no overhead cabinet. And so you have to see what you're comfortable with, but that may mean that you have, you know, the longest stretches you can. Broken up counter space makes you crazy because you can never sprawl out. I think the other thing you really need to think about is a floor that has give. Tile floors and all those other floors, they're really pretty in those magazines, and they can kill your feet so fast. You know, you start cooking dinner and you walk around on the sides of your ankles because your legs hurt. And you know, think about a cushioned floor, or think about something like a nice sprung wooden floor. I'm trying to think, what else? Someone said something to me when I was redoing my kitchen that I thought was really smart, because you can never afford everything you want. And she said, she's a designer, and she said, put your money into things that would be very expensive to replace. So cabinets, get the best you can get, because they're going to be very expensive to replace. A countertop's pretty easy to upgrade at the time when you want to upgrade. And I have Formica. I have white Formica. And I love it because I can bleach it every time it gets scratched. You know, and someday I'm going to have something else. By the way, the newest thing in counters, forget granite. It is now padded stainless steel.
Padded?
Stainless steel. It's what they have in restaurants. You know, it doesn't make noise, but it can take endless beating. It can take heat. You know, you can pull the pot off the stove, stick it on the countertop, and nothing's going to happen.
Yeah, but I have two kids, too, so it could get kind of...
Oh, but you know what? You get a pewter finish on it. You know, you get like a brush finish, so you'll never see a scratch. I'll tell you, granite will drive you nuts because it's going to scratch in 4 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so hard. You know, it makes the kitchen sound tinny. Always, and the other thing is, it's more expensive, but it really saves your back. Think of drawers instead of shelves, especially for heavy things like pots and pans that you can roll out and pick up easily. And put drawers where your kick plates are. You know, at the very bottom of the floor?
Yeah.
Shallow drawers where you can put the platters, like for Thanksgiving and stuff like that, that you use once a year.
Oh, yeah.
You use every inch of space that way. And always have two big sinks side by side as your main sink. Forget the big one big sink.
Sure.
Because mine is, if I do one big sink, what is always filled with greasy dishes when I want to wash the lettuce. I could go on and on, but that's basically, you know, the idea.
Oh, this is great.
Oh, I hope it helps.
Oh, it is. We're going to do the island thing and a pantry, a walk-in
great.
Pantry.
And one other thing, the best appliances you can afford, because, I mean, you can replace them, obviously, but that's what's going to give you real pleasure.
Definitely.
You know, whether it's a French country cherry cabinet, that's one thing. But when that stove cranks up, you're going to have a blast.
Oh, that's going to be so fun.
Oh, hey, I envy you, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
You know, this whole business about how you plan a kitchen, think counter space. Whatever you think you need, do it 50% more. Because when you get done with putting down the newspaper, pulling the bowl out of the refrigerator, taking something off the stove, everybody piles mail someplace, you need counter space. And ideally not with a lot of overhead cabinets. Well, guys, you can call us 800-537-5252. 52. Okay, let's see. Who is up next? We've got Andrew calling from Atlantic, Iowa. Hey, Andrew, what's up?
I have a lot of game birds and poultry, and I was wondering if you could give me some sort of rules of thumb with regard to marinating poultry and any specific maybe marinade recipes that you might have.
Okay, all right. Well, I mean, poultry, do you raise the poultry yourself?
I'm a hunter.
Oh, you're a hunter. Okay, because that means you are really getting wild game, not
Correct.
Farm game, right?
Correct.
Oh, yeah, you're going to be eating great game. You know, a lot of people want to marinate the you-know-what out of game because they want to kill the taste.
Sure.
And I'm one of those people who, you know, if you've gone out there and you've gone through what you go through to get your game, you want to eat the game.
Correct.
So I would do stuff that doesn't kill the flavor, but just enhances it. So I'll give you one instance. Tell me, what kind of game birds do you get usually?
Well, pheasants and quail.
Okay. Okay. These, oh gosh, you're going to, oh Lord. This is what I would do with quail. Okay. I would just take them. I would lightly rub them with garlic, olive oil, some fresh thyme. Okay. Maybe a little balsamic vinegar. And I butterfly mine. Just because they're easy, they're much easier to cook. Tuck them in the fridge overnight, or you can just tuck them in the fridge for a couple of, you know, a couple of hours. And then I pan saute them. You are going to dine like a king. So there's one basic marinade. Garlic with whatever herb you like, a little balsamic vinegar, and olive oil. Now, for things like pheasant, with the pheasant, I always cook the breasts separate from the legs because the legs can be like rubber bands, but the breast can be, you know, as you know, can be on the tender side,
sure.
Especially if you slice it across the grain. Now, with there, you might want to fool around a little bit. You might want to try something Asian. And, you know, I'm talking here like fish sauce, Thai fish sauce, or even soy sauce. And then you do a little bit of white wine with that, a tad of brown sugar, some fresh ginger and garlic. And let that sit in that again overnight, or if you want to, just for a couple of hours. And with the legs, brown the legs and then add some of that marinade and some more white wine and broth and let them cook and braise them, you know, until they're really tender. But with the breasts, just saute those breasts lightly and slice them across the grain in thin slices. So there's two families. You can vary those flavorings, but you've got the Asian side and sort of the Mediterranean side.
Can you give me kind of a rule of thumb as to how long generally you would want to do poultry? I mean, I've seen where, you know, recipes say just chill in the refrigerator for a few hours, but I didn't know if...
You never want to... First of all, I always put a fair amount of oil in these marinades. You don't want so much acid that it toughens the meat.
Right.
I would do it no more than about 12 hours.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But
overnight,
I think
would be easy.
That would be easy. Yeah. And it's really easy. You stick them in there overnight and that's it, you know, and then you pull them out.
Well, that sounds great. Well, and I surely appreciate it.
And I envy you having all that great game. You take care, Andrew.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
You know how we keep hearing nutrition promises? Take this vitamin and look younger. Take that mineral and feel happier. Well, how about the idea that vitamins can change criminal behavior? A physiologist at the University of Oxford in England has been doing some experiments. He's Bernard Gesch, and we've got him on the phone. Mr. Gesch, thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Now, can you explain what you've been doing?
Well, all we were simply trying to find out was, with the cooperation of the UK Home Office, whether what we eat actually affects the way we behave. So we chose to do a study in a maximum security prison simply because the prisoners, all the sources of food they get are known. So what we did, we gave some of the prisoners real nutritional supplements to make sure that their diet reached broadly the USRDAs of vitamins and minerals, plus specials called fatty acids.
Mm-hmm.
And the others got fake capsules called placebos. And what we did was over 9 months in the prison, basically see how many offences they committed.
So what were the conclusions?
Well, they were quite dramatic, to be honest. I mean, the group which received the placebo capsule showed no change in behaviour. But remarkably, the group which received the extra nutrients reduced their offending overall by about 35%.
And is this, I mean, this is a consistency that people understand, that this was a valid 35%. There was no fluke in this.
Well, what we call the statistical power of the trial, which means how certain you can be on a statistical basis, was 92%. So, strictly speaking, we can say there's 8% doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, 92% would be good enough in a clinical trial to be one of the statutory trials involved in licensing a drug on the open market. So that's pretty good evidence, to say the least.
How many subjects were there, by the way?
231 involved in the trial.
Well, that's a sizable amount. So now, does this mean that supplements like this are going to be given out in prisons in the UK?
Well, we're working on a much larger study to not only repeat the question, does it work in a number of institutions, so we can then close the gap on the possibility that this was a fluke even further.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also looking to see whether we can begin to identify what are the critical nutrients involved in the changes in behaviour. But there are a number of other European countries which are interested in this, and they're already talking about possibly using nutrition in the community as a way of actually reducing offending. I think the point is that giving people a better diet, there is, in a health sense, absolutely no downside to it, and it appears that there are many advantages from a behavioral perspective as well.
Hmm. Fascinating. Thank you so much, Bernard Gesch.
Well, my pleasure.
Bernard Gesch is a physiologist at the University of Oxford in England. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this observation from Mark Twain. Cauliflower is nothing but a cabbage with education. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. You can register for it on the site. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. John Marston produced the Blue in Tokyo piece, and thanks to Japan Airlines for getting them there. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Thanks for tuning in. See you next time. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.